Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, forest fires in the West are extensive this year. Jack Ward Thomas, chief of the U.S. Forest Services, assesses their ecological impact and the need for new fire policy. Ecotourism, a means of providing income for indigenous people and preserving the environment, or a destructive green scam? We'll look at the ecotourism industry and then go to Botswana. We'll meet a citizen leader heading a movement to help community activists keep big box retailers like Walmart out of their hometowns. It's hurricane season, and our Earth calendar catches the wind. These stories coming up this week on The Environment Show. It's been a pretty tough year for forest fires in the West, and the fire season isn't over yet. The area within the perimeter of the fires exceeds 1 million acres for the third time in 10 years. Previously, the norm was less than half as much. The chief of the U.S. Forest Service, Jack Ward Thomas, who is an ecologist by training, assesses the ecological impact of the fires to date.
Some of these fires have been low intensity and perhaps even beneficial. Some of them in very areas of very high fuel loading have been very hot and very large, and those I would not mark off as ecologically beneficial. But the thing that we need to keep in mind is that fire has been part of these systems, long before we showed up as forest and range managers. It's not going a question of whether these areas burn. It's a matter of when they burn. It's a matter of how they burn, and we need to start thinking our way into a more comprehensive fire policy and forest range management policy than has been extant in the past.
As we become more tolerant of fire from a public policy standpoint, do you anticipate some of the hotter and more damaging fires will be less frequent in the future because there will not have been the fuel buildup that has occurred in recent times?
Well, I think it's a leap of faith to say that we have support for that. It's going to take some time to sensitize the American public to the fact that we need to be dealing with fire management. Now, fire management can, in some areas, we've got too much fuel buildup to intentionally let an area burn. We would need to thin stands so the canopies did not touch. We would need to clear up large amounts of dead wood on the forest floor. In some of these cases, there simply is not any way for fire to burn without burning in a very hot and perhaps very extensive way.
Thomas believes that we have to achieve a better consensus about fire management to avoid the situation we're now in.
The main idea in this, I think, is that we developed probably the most effective firefighting mechanism ever existed in the world between the multiple federal agencies, the states, and others. But we now have to begin to think about we need a fire management organization as opposed to a firefighting organization, which would mean that we would spend more money up front in terms of fuel reduction, the use of prescribed fire, essentially not fireproofing, but dampening fire danger in the urban-forest interface and a number of other approaches, but simply just continuing to fight fire without addressing the real questions is an exercise in long-term futility.
The need to revise our forest policy is only part of a bigger and unresolved question that has to do with conflicting land management policies enacted by the Congress. These call for maximizing timber cut on one hand and preserving biodiversity on the other. In addition, Thomas says a de facto policy has emerged which calls for federal lands to be primarily involved when it comes to preserving habitat under the Endangered Species Act. The result is a number of conflicting directions and policies which Thomas says makes it very difficult for the federal resource specialists and which make it hard to manage fire. Today, many people spend their vacations on guided tours, watching birds and wildlife, and exploring undeveloped lands at home and in the far corners of the planet. Dubbed ecotourism, these activities are promoted as a way to achieve conservation while generating income for local people. But as Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports, not all ecotours are created equal.
Eco-friendly products are everywhere today. Ice cream, clothing, toothpaste, paper, cleaners, and now vacations are the marks of today's eco-elite. But before you sign up for a so-called eco-tour, experts say know what you're getting into.
At a conference that I chaired several years ago, which were a number of specialists in the field, we decided that really ecotourism was nothing more than a marketing strategy or a marketing tool. I've seen the term defined in at least 100 ways, and it's been applied from everything to large-scale Hilton hotel developments that recycle to what I think of ecotourism as being, which is a much more nature-based kind of tourism.
Katrina Brandon is with the Nature Conservancy. She recently wrote a report on ecotourism for the World Bank. She says ecotourism is the largest and fastest growing sector of the tourism market. Although many ecotours live up to their promises, Brandon says the industry is unregulated.
There's no standards at all on what ecotourism means, and the Ecotourism Society has been trying to develop a set of questionnaires and standards of what that might mean, and almost a green labeling program, so you'd have some idea what is implied by that. But right now, any consumers need to be very careful, and I think there's a lot of people who take trips who are hoping that they're somehow going to be environmentally sound or sustainable, but there's no guarantees of that.
Brandon and others say ecotourism is still a new industry. It emerged as a way to serve the interests of environmentally conscious customers. But tourism is the largest industry in the world, and ecotourism has proved that it can attract big money. Kathleen Murphy is with the Ecotourism Society. They're presently working on an accreditation system, but it's still several years away.
Trying to gather as much information as you can and being really a discriminating consumer, because you are a consumer in this process and you are buying a product. So if someone were going out and buying a TV or VCR or even a house, they would go through a huge amount of research. And I think it's important to research this as much as it is to buy something tangible. And I think that's probably the best advice that we could give at the moment, is to try to use as many resources as you can.
Murphy says good ecotourism holds conservation as the primary goal. This means adequate management of the tour areas, and local and indigenous people should share in both the profits and running of the operation. Brad Northrup runs the Nature Conservancy's Parks in Peril program. He says some countries have created parks and preserves that are merely there to attract eco dollars.
They are in many cases paper parks, in the sense that they're legally mandated by the legislatures of these countries. But in fact, on the ground, there is no resources. There are no resources there. We know of million-acre parks where there's one or two park guards that are assigned to that area.
And ecotourism, no matter how it's done, is never without impact. Richard Premack is a plant ecologist at Boston University. He and a partner, Brian Drayton, studied Middlesex Fells, a heavily used wooded area near Boston, Massachusetts. They discovered that in 100 years, the woods had lost more than 150 plant species, due in part to its heavy use by nature enthusiasts. Nevertheless, when applied to areas of the world facing severe threats to the environment, ecotourism is often the best option. He cites the example of Belize, where a lot of people have been attracted to the world-class scuba diving. But the tourism industry there has grown so quickly that hotels have developed without adequate sewage treatment systems.
And so this is an example where such a rapid growth of an industry has resulted in the destruction of an ecosystem. But again, I want to point out that this is often, you know, very, very local in nature and is often relatively minor in comparison with other impacts on these coral reef systems.
So from your experiences, on balance, ecotourism is a better option than logging or other extractive industries?
Undoubtedly, that ecotourism has local impacts in contrast to other extractive activities, which often have vast and widespread activities. The key is to start to think about how to better practice this very young industry.
If you're thinking of an ecotourism vacation, experts suggest running the plan by a conservation organization. Many even run their own ecotours. The Ecotourism Society can be reached via email at ecotsocy@igc.apc.org. That's ecotsocy@igc.apc.org. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Hear any of our last four shows via the Internet. Go to our webpage at www.wamc.org/env and click on Listen to The Environment Show. That's www.wamc.org/env. While the travel industry works to establish standards for ecotourism, the lure of tourist dollars continues to be too much for some countries to resist. Thomas Lally recently spoke with Dr. Megan Beasley, who works with the African nation of Botswana, with the Basarwa people, or Bush people. There, the Basarwa are being pushed off their land in favor of development, including ecotourism.
The Kalahari region in the southern African country of Botswana must appear to many Western eyes as a barren land of sand dunes and dry riverbeds. But people have lived there for at least 40,000 years. The Bush people have survived by migrating over enormous swaths of land, harvesting numerous wild crops, and hunting the plentiful game. Dr. Megan Beasley is a professor of anthropology at Rice University and the University of Texas, and a consultant for both the countries of Namibia and Botswana. She says the knowledge of the Bush people is today threatened, ironically, by so-called ecotourism.
In the Central Kalahari Game Reserve, which is about a 52,000 square kilometer area in the center of Botswana, people who were invited to live there starting in 1961 as part of a conservation effort for both human populations and for game populations are now being asked to leave that reserve in the name of so-called ecotourism. They are told that if they remain in the reserve, they will no longer be able to do any hunting and gathering because that area must be kept pristine for ecotourism.
Beasley says the Bush people rely on their knowledge of the environment for hunting and finding food. They've become an essential part of the Kalahari, stabilizing the prey population and even setting controlled burns. Losing the Bush people and changing the Kalahari won't just mean a diminished experience for ecotourists. Beasley says the lost knowledge of indigenous people affects us all as we grapple with ways of making our unwieldy population, nearing 8 billion, sustainable.
Are there ways in which we can learn lessons of sustainability from these groups of people before their lives are changed completely and before their knowledge is lost? Are there also ways in which our civilization can make affirmative gestures in the direction of these most senior citizens of the planet? I would say that this is a matter which concerns us all, and it is not at all a matter of abstract morality, but rather a matter of utmost practicality when you think of environmental sustainability.
Megan Beasley is an anthropology professor at Rice University and the University of Texas. She says when done right, ecotourism can support indigenous people, but it often changes them and the ecosystems in which they live. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Bitter battles are raging in hundreds of communities across America over proposals by developers to build huge retail malls on the outskirts of small and medium-sized municipalities. Proponents say the malls bring jobs. Others say they destroy Main Street and local businesses. Al Norman is a self-styled sprawl buster, and when not engaged in his regular job, he travels around the country helping citizen groups fight what he calls the big box developers, like Walmart and Home Depot. He says he got involved almost by accident when the town council of his home community in Greenfield, Massachusetts, approved the construction of a Walmart on the edge of town. Fearing that this would doom Main Street, as has happened in many other small cities, he organized a referendum to reverse the zoning change that the town council had granted. After a bitter battle, the town council was overridden at the ballot box, and Walmart abandoned the project. Norman says the big box developers usually get support from local officials by making economic projections that did not hold up. What happens, he said, is the developers count the number of jobs added by the new facility, but do not subtract the jobs lost on Main Street when mom-and-pop stores are driven out of business.
Well, I call that wall math. Wall math is one job created minus one job destroyed equals one job. They don't know how to subtract. What these developers will do is they'll come into a community, and they, for example, in my town, they said, we're going to create 170 jobs and $90,000 worth of property tax revenue. An economic impact report was done. Walmart had to pay for it. It cost them $35,000, an independent study. And it showed that under one scenario, the job generation was seven jobs, not 170. And the property taxes came to $1.50 per person per year, which prompted one of our local citizens to say, look, for $1.50, I'll pay you to stay out of town.
Betsy Rethemeyer, spokesperson for Walmart stores, sees no merit to Norman's arguments about jobs and suffering Main Streets.
There's also a study done that was just out this year out of Iowa State University where they simulated some small towns. And in going and talking to actual community leaders, people in small towns believe that, yes, their businesses are severely threatened. But interestingly enough, they believe that government regulation is more of a serious threat. Finding quality labor is a second problem, followed closely by taxes. So it isn't necessarily the influx of other competition that's a problem as much as other factors.
Another problem Norman sees with the big box developers is that they will build a number of stores in an area and then shut some of them down, shifting businesses to the remaining store, which is converted to a huge regional center. This leaves behind communities who suffered twice, first as local businesses collapsed when the shopping center was built, and again when the big chain store outlet moved on.
It's a matter of record now that Walmart's strategy, Sam Walton talked a lot about it in his autobiography, that they would move out to an area where there weren't a lot of competing stores. Then they would saturate the area, fill in with a bunch of stores in one area, and then look to see which ones weren't performing as well and thin them out. So that you had, for example, stories about towns in Oklahoma that or Texas that were killed twice. You know, once when they moved in, they killed out the competition, and then the second time when the big box moved out, leaving nothing, not even a store available to buy a pair of pants.
Walmart confirms that closing stores is a regular part of its business. Betsy Rethemeyer, Walmart spokesman, explains how they do it.
We have not made any secret of the fact that we think the wave of retail future is certainly in our supercenter areas, and where possible, we are going to expand existing stores. That certainly makes sense from a business end. But when not possible, then there may be instances when we do need to relocate a store. However, Peter, I think it's important to realize that Walmart is one of the few large corporations who has a full-time, rather large staff who works actively in the communities to put tenants back into those stores.
Al Norman says that unlike more global environmental problems, coping with sprawl can be managed at the community level by enacting tough and unambiguous zoning and land use controls. Once a project is proposed, however, he says it takes a good land use attorney, a community organizer who can also get the word out to the press, a war chest, and a lot of volunteers to oppose it.
Towns have to go back to the drawing board and say, does our master plan really give us a vision of where we want to be 10 or 20 years from now? Does our zoning reflect that as well? And one of the beauties of this whole movement against the big box retailers is that it is a local control movement. Zoning is one of the few areas that you and I really can have some control over. Well, you know what I say about Walmart? I say they're like they hate it when I say this, but I say they're like a cheap pair of underwear. They keep creeping up on you, and they brag about it. That's, you know, the two items that they like to tell their stockholders about is how much underwear they sell and that they sell a Barbie doll every other second. Well, I don't care much about Barbie dolls or cheap underwear. I think the quality of life and the economics of my local community are more important than their Barbie dolls.
Al Norman is a self-styled sprawl buster, and when not engaged in his regular job, he travels around the country helping citizen groups fight what he calls the big box developers. People on the east and Gulf coasts of the United States are bracing for high winds, storm surges, and flooding. In this week's Earth Calendar, we find out about hurricane season. Why do hurricanes hit at this time of year? According to B.J. Copeland, director of the North Carolina Sea Grant College Program, it all has to do with warm water and wind that chases itself around in a circle.
Well, at this time of year, the water has gotten warm as it warmed up all year. And the trade winds are moving in a kind of a westerly direction. And so you wind up with these lows being formed, and that creates a little cell which starts spiraling because of the differences in pressure. And as this spiral gets tighter and more rapid, you wind up with a eye that's called a hurricane. When it gets to, 74 miles an hour, it becomes a hurricane, and so the winds can go on up from there.
A hurricane is a cataclysmic and damaging event, frequently moving quantities of sand and water along with practically everything else that's not tied down. Copeland observes that Mother Nature is resilient.
You'll have something like this come in which moves a lot of water. And the water moves a lot of sediment and sand and things like that. And so the system will recover from that impact by recreating colonies of animals and plants and things like that. But sometimes you can get things covered up so deeply that they can't recover at all. And so you wind up with large problems like several years ago when a hurricane put a lot of water into Chesapeake Bay and covered up submerged seagrasses. And so, you know, these kinds of things can happen, and they can be quite devastating ecologically. But as I say, Mother Nature will go to work trying to reform what was there.
Like humans, animals often pick up and leave when they sense a hurricane is on the way. The critters don't have the benefit of computer predictions based on data collected by aircraft flying into the eye of the storm. But then, too, they're spared another product of the electronic era, the computer-selected hurricane name. I've heard philosophers who say that things only begin to exist in human consciousness when we give them names. Following that train of thought, I propose that if we want to eliminate the hurricane threat, we simply dismantle the computer that names them. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 349. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is a producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, and the Furthermore Foundation. And Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.